The Saskatchewan Healthcare Coalition is hosting the All for Public Healthcare Rally in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, May 4th. It's free and you're invited. This rally is happening because our public healthcare system does not have the support it needs to meet the diverse needs of all Saskatchewan residents. For years, it has been underfunded, ignored, and hindered, so join Donna and I in person on May 4th in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan for a walk, speeches, networking, and community building. Link for more information is in the show notes. Hope to see you there. This time, things will be different. A line so many of us that have been addicted have used time and time again. Mark Ifron was no different. As a man now in long-term recovery, Mark came up in the world with a very strong work ethic, and it served him well. Vice president of an insurance company at 24 years old, cocaine fueled his fire. Until it didn't, homeless at 28 years old. Now with many years of sobriety under his belt, he joined me on the podcast and shared his valuable insights and experiences on what happened and how he pulled his way out. But before we bring him in, what's up? My name's Dan, podcaster, keynote speaker, and advocate, and this is Hard Knocks Talks, your addictions podcast. If you're interested in fostering productive conversations about substance use in your community, organization, or event, reach out to us at daniel@hardknockstalks.com to learn more about our public speaking and onstage live podcast productions. And with that, let's get into my conversation with Mark Ifron.
This is Hard Knocks Talks.
What's up, Mark? How are you?
I'm great, man. How you doing?
I'm doing well. It's a beautiful Friday morning up here in Saskatchewan. I'm sure it's sunny and beautiful down there in South Florida. Am I wrong?
Oh, no, you're not. Not a cloud in the sky here in Fort Lauderdale.
Awesome. So I'm glad your team reached out to me a little while ago. We had a chance to chat a little while ago too. I got a great vibe when we had our conversation last. So before we get into it though, is there anything that you'd like to kick us off with? Anything like you'd like to say?
Yeah, I mean, I'm honored to be here. Definitely had the same vibe with you. I think the mission is very much the same. It's about having a healthier, safer, more open environment to have conversation about, you know, the mm-hmm. topics we're going to talk about today. So I'm properly motivated. I'm happy to be here, man.
Awesome. Well, let's jump in. Why don't you start off telling us a little bit about how your own journey got started with substance use? Was this something that you were born into?
So, you know, I didn't grow up with a raging mother or father that were, you know, blatantly alcoholic or drunk or drug addicts. It wasn't blatant. Mm-hmm. But I'm 47 years old, so I was born in 1976 in a mm-hmm. small town in Boston. And in 1978, there was a massive blizzard that blew through the Northeast. They called it the Blizzard of 78. And long story short, my parents had a party and I was two. And when I was found upstairs, I had pulled out all of my mother's dresser drawers, climbed to the top of her dresser and ripped open a bag of her cocaine. Mm. And, you know, that was, although I don't remember it, I fact checked it. You know, the story goes like this. I was rushed to the hospital. I was medically discharged and I wound up, you know, being released to my mom and dad. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's why I turned out to have a drug habit or not. I think it was a whole lot more than that, but that was my first time I ever ingested any type of substance.
Yeah. So it was around, but it wasn't what you would call problematic in the family system.
Yeah. Social drinking, social drug use, definitely not problematic back then, no.
I honestly, that just seems so foreign to me that someone can have a big bag of cocaine in their drawer and just not like snort it until everything's gone.
Well, you know, late 70s, you know, early 80s, it was, that was kind of the era, and that's what they did. They did Quaaludes, they did cocaine, and mm-hmm. during this blizzard, there was a lot of people there. Yeah. You know, I don't remember seeing drugs in my home after. You know, clearly I don't remember that because I was two and I'm a father. I have little kids. I could never imagine one of my boys, Maven or Max, putting them into that situation. Yeah. You know, even medication today, if I get sick, like over-the-counter type stuff, like that stuff's double, triple check. That's way top shelf. Yeah. But yeah. No, man, my real first drink was I was about 8 years old and I'll never forget it. You know, I was home early from school one day. Again, living outside Boston in this small town called Swampscott. Mm-hmm. And we had a liquor cabinet that was built into the wall, and you'd open up the cabinet and there were all these bottles in there. I had no idea what they were, but I went for the one that had a purple velvety bag with some mm-hmm. gold writing on it. And, you know, I'm sure you know what that was, and your listeners do too. And I cracked that open. I don't know why. I took a sip of it, and the warmth came down my throat and into my belly, and I instantly felt relief. And at that time, my parents were separated, going through a divorce. So, you know, I was very like, what's going on? I'm not love type of feeling inside, you know, as an 8-year-old. Mm-hmm. I remember that feeling, but I also remember in an instant, the feeling being gone.
I'm home.
And so that was my first drink, man. And I wound up taking the bottle and I went out back into the bushes and, you know, I had a party solo dolo just by myself.
At 8 years old.
And that's how I got started. At 8 years old. Yeah. That was my first drink.
So what was it like? What was it like after that? Was it like the switch had flipped and your life became all about it right away? Or was this something that you could just like turn to when things got dark? I mean, at 8 years old, I mean, I don't even know how you would distinguish that, but.
No, it wasn't like that. It was, well, right after that, I got really sick. And I said I would never do that again. Uh-huh. Until, you know, until you have like, it's no different now in sobriety, but, and I don't want to like go back and forth like early days nowadays, but looking back, separation from the alcohol, went with my dad, they were separated, the feelings coming home were empty. I knew that instantly if I took a sip of something, I would feel relief. Like mm-hmm. I knew that intuitively, mm-hmm. even at that age. So yeah, it was drinking in between, but I was an athlete. So, and I was pretty good at a young age. And so from like 8 until 16, like that pocket of time, it was never an uncontrollable drinking situation for me, but I always knew where to go find it. If I wanted some sort of, you know, emotional release, mm-hmm. I leaned on alcohol because it was there. But I wasn't drinking alcoholically, you know, looking back. Yeah. But if it wasn't for sports, man, who knows? Because I had to show up and I got to show up back then. I played baseball and basketball and I was really good at it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always thought that I was going to become a pro ball player. That was my plan. So, you know, you would back then it was like Guns N' Roses, Van Halen, AC/DC, you know. And so you know, Run DMC. I listened to all of it because I didn't really know. I didn't have an identity. The mm-hmm. only thing that I knew was that I was a really good athlete. And if it wasn't for my coaches and my teammates back then, I don't know really what would have happened.
Yeah.
But when I was 16, you know, I started to, you know, get into more trouble and I didn't have a whole lot of discipline, man. So I turned to drinking and drugs. That's when drugs came into my system was, I was 16 years old. I tripped on my first thing at LSD and I remember the feeling of it and I didn't necessarily like it. I didn't have control. But that was the first domino for me mm-hmm. was like, wow, okay. I don't have a whole lot of discipline except when it comes to sports. I'm not a great student.
Yeah.
My parents did the best that they could with the information that they had. And I didn't blame them. I didn't blame them for any of it, but I was not happy with me. I didn't really have an identity. And so when things got hard, I dropped out of high school.
So let's take a pause there for a second. So when you were presented with these substances, like you said, at 16, you tried LSD. Now, had there been any narrative in your life prior to that, like, oh, drugs are bad, don't do drugs, they'll wreck your life? And when that was presented to you, what were your thoughts? Was it like, give it here? Or was it like, I'm scared of that, I'm sort of going to back off?
Yeah, Nancy Reagan.
Here we go.
You know, just don't. No, but that's, I'm just saying, I'm not going political. I'm not a political, yeah. That was the thing. Right?
The only reason bring that up is because we hear Nancy Reagan often on the show.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, well, good. Then I'm not that unique. So in that sense, but no, that it was like the egg and it was the frying pan and this is your brain on drugs. That was that and DARE back then. So there wasn't a lot of information. There was a commercial that I didn't really fully understand because nobody, my parents didn't sit me down like I do my kids now and say, hey, listen, this is what alcohol is. This is what drugs are. This is the different types of drugs. This is the informs that it could come. Don't eat this brownie. Like I'm educating my kids where I didn't have that education. So when it did show up, it was like, all right, so what is this? What's it going to do to me? How am I going to feel? For how long? And but I still did it because I wanted to be a part of, and I'm not going to call it peer pressure because that's not really what it was, but I wanted to be a part of, like my boys were doing it. I wanted to do it. They did this thing called the disco biscuit. I wanted to try a disco biscuit. So I did it. There were certain drugs that I did that I didn't necessarily like the output in my body. I like how I feel, but there was one drug in particular that I became a victim to, man. Like, It owned me in every part of my fiber, and that was cocaine. So,
how old were you when you hit that?
I was 16. I was 16. It was all the same year. It was, you know, I got kicked out of my dad's house, and I had, you know, I had serious issues, man. Like I was, like I said, I wanted to be a pro baseball player, and I was really good at it. And when my position got taken down here, I was in Florida. From a kid who was just much better than me, my self-esteem dropped and I really just didn't give a shit about much. And I was looking and seeking validation from people, situations, girls, you know, sex. I was looking anything that was going to make me feel loved as I understood love back then. And for me back then, love meant hold me and have sex with me. And that's all kidding aside, because that's another topic, you know, that I don't think a lot of people talk about is their self-esteem and the things that they would do to validate themselves, right, wrong, or indifferent. So, you know, I had a lot of sex and I did a lot of drugs and eventually I just dropped out of high school at 16, the end of my sophomore year going into my junior year.
What did mom and dad have to say?
So back then, my father was remarried with another family, and you know, he chose that other family, and that's okay because I got a good relationship with my dad today. My mom is I'm always going to be a little baby, so she was, you know, she wished more for me, but it was what it was. And I'll tell you what, like I wouldn't change a part of my story, man. None of it, even that 2 years old. 8 years old, you know, being a young teen, you know, experimenting with drugs and sex and having my heart broken a bunch of times, like none of it would I change because all those little moments brought me into my adulthood, which that's where the real problems began. Because, you know, all of us today as adults, we have this inner child inside of us and I'm still constantly working on it. I've done a lot of work on it, of healing it. But we grow up as adolescents and the brokenness, if not looked at and really, you don't really dig down deep on that brokenness as an adolescent. You bring that into your teenage and then your adult years. And then we wonder why we become a mess. And, and then we get married and we don't want to address those things. So it's all tied. So when I was in my 20s, I started making money, you know, like the lack of degree didn't much matter. I got around a bunch of guys. They taught me finance. They taught me sales and marketing, and they gave me an education that I couldn't have gotten in school or college. And I got licensed and I started wearing a suit and I thought I was sophisticated and I started making money. And then by the time I was 24, I was the vice president of an insurance company here in the United States. And that's not to impress you or anybody. That's not really that impressive. What was super cool was like, I found my lane. I thought my life was over. I was going to turn out to be a drug addict and a high school dropout. You know, everybody in my family was and is an overachiever. They were high educated people and I was the black sheep. So
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Do you think at any point in your 20s or in your late teens, was the cocaine serving you well?
Late teens, early 20s. Late teens, no, definitely not.
Yeah.
In the 20s, I don't know if I would say served me well. I had no problems with it. Like I could do cocaine and function. Yeah. You know, I was working a lot of hours, 80, 90 hours a week, nonstop, just grinding, trying to figure out my lane. And so it went hand in hand. It kept me going, you know, and that in the late 90s, when I got into the financial industry in 1997, that was kind of the thing. It was like there was a huge stock market run, 97, 98, 99, and everybody's blowing cocaine and everybody's having a good time drinking martinis at lunch. Uh-huh. It was normalized for me. I'm supposed to do cocaine, you know, and drink martinis at lunch and go produce the rest of the day. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I was about 26, 27, a couple years later, you know, and I'd made a lot of money and I was traveling a lot and the little child inside of me started to catch up. You know, the undisciplined one, the one that wasn't loved and the one that wasn't validated, because money only validates you for so long. Money is great. Money is just freedom and freedom of choice and freedom to do different things or help and serve different people. That's really what money is.
Yeah.
But it's important in life. Back then it was everything to me because I'm like, shit, I'm a high school dropout without a college degree. I better make as much as I can. And you know what? I'm going to prove to everybody that I got what it takes. And so I did whatever it took.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time I was 26, I was going on benders. Mm-hmm. Like I'm talking, it would start on Friday night. It would roll into Sunday. I would sleep on Monday and I would only work Tuesday through Thursday until I lost my career in the beginning. I was 26 going on 27. And because of drugs and alcohol, that big boy job that I got was gone. It was gone in a heartbeat. And my reputation got a little tarnished in the financial industry down here in the South. And, you know, I thought it was just like, well, you know, I was young. I made a lot of money quick. And I was living in Atlanta. Maybe it's Atlanta. Maybe it's the people I'm with. Maybe, you know what? Let me go to South Florida. You know, let me move down to South Florida.
Uh-huh.
So that's what I did. And I quickly got another job. And you know what? Here's the thing about drugs and alcohol. They're tricky. It's tricky. It's cunning and baffling and powerful. And they talk about it in the basic text of a fellowship that I go to. And, you know, and it really is cunning, baffling, and powerful. That thing wants me dead. Addiction wants me dead. And I know that today, but back then I had no idea. So when I got to South Florida, I got a new career, same industry, but with a new company and, same title, same responsibilities. Nobody knew that I had a drinking or drug problem at the time. Mm-hmm. But here's the crazy part. I didn't want to get drunk. I didn't want to do cocaine. I didn't want to escape what I was feeling. I was like, well, wait a minute. This is a geographical change, you know, maybe I'm going to leave all that behind me once and for all. And that's not what happened. You know, it was quick, man. It snuck up on me quick. I was down here for about 6 months and these hurricanes crisscrossed the state of Florida back then, literally wiped out the East Coast, West Coast at the same time and everything in between.
Wow.
Power was out for weeks and I was outside barbecuing. And almost like a cartoon where I could see like this smoke and this smell and this odor. And it just kind of went right up my nose. It was somebody who was smoking marijuana, some weed down the street. I followed the scent like a cartoon. And I asked the guy, hey, man, what else can you get? He's like, what you need? I said, well, I think this is what I'm looking for, man. Can you get it? He's like, yeah, absolutely. I'll have it for you about an hour. And I went on a 2-year run out of nowhere. Didn't even see it coming, man. I was the last to know. You know, in the world down here at that time, it kind of shut down. So it's like, what else am I going to do? I don't have to go to work. You know, there's no real running water. So that's what I did. I went on a run and everything that I had built up, I brought to the ground. This is 2006. I found myself unemployable. Go ahead.
Did you see yourself... Did you see it happening while it was happening and just couldn't stop? Or were you completely blind to the carnage you were placing on the life that you had rebuilt?
That's a great question. I said this at the beginning, you know, you're very articulate in the way that you and strategic on how you ask things. Absolutely. Yeah. Looking back, and I hadn't really thought about it until right now when you asked. I could see myself going down the path that I had gone the years prior, mm-hmm. but I was like, it's going to be different this time. It's going to be different. Mm-hmm. I got this. We're good. That was Atlanta. I'm a couple of years older. I got it now. Mm-hmm. No, man. Once the beast is woken up inside of me, it's uncontrollable and I can't stop it.
Yeah.
I can't stop it. And I can't stop it. I mean, and it's a cycle, right? There's like a process. I don't know about other alcoholics. I hear it that there is, but, and I don't know if, you know, you can relate to like, or your listeners can relate to this, but if I knew I was going to get high or drunk, I had a process. I knew that I needed to be in a certain spot at a certain mm-hmm. time. I need a certain cigarette, a certain amount. Like I was very detailed with I knew that I was going to go to this club first, but I could only be there for about 40 minutes before I start getting paranoid. So then I'm going to go to this motel. And that's ultimately where I ended up. Like I had rebuilt my life from Atlanta. And when these hurricanes crisscrossed and I asked that question, because I wasn't in fellowship, I didn't have a support group. I wasn't talking to people. I just mm-hmm. acted like that was the past because I didn't know any better. So I ended up in a motel for days on end, and those days turned up to years and I lost everything, you know? Yeah. So I didn't even see it coming. I was the last to know. And yeah. when it was happening, I thought it was just the past, but I couldn't stop.
Yeah. Yeah. So what you burnt it all down again, was that the end for you? Was that when you made the decision to turn it around?
No, that was 2006. I lost everything, my house, cars, my credit was shot. And, everybody in my family at that point pretty much had written me off because they saw it. This time they saw it. See, when I was in Atlanta, they mm-hmm. didn't see it. So they saw the wheels come off. They tried to do some interventions on me, and I wasn't ready. I tried to go to treatment, drug and alcohol treatment in 2006. And I went, begrudgingly, I went with a trash bag. That's all that I had left to my name at the time. And a bag of beef jerky, a tin of tobacco, Sports Illustrated. It was salty. It wasn't good beef jerky. It was gas station beef jerky. It wasn't good. It wasn't that homemade stuff.
So, hang on a second. What did the interventions look like? Because we have a lot of family that watch, and you know, I'll ask you, like, you know, what did mom and dad think, and what did, but trying to draw the family into it. So I'm curious, what did those interventions that didn't work look like?
So there's one in particular where we were in a restaurant at a round table, and my brother was drinking tequila. My sisters were in high school and too young to really fully understand. Mm-hmm. My dad just wanted his son to get better. So it was my sister-in-law, love her to pieces. She was kind of the one orchestrating the whole thing. But she didn't have a certified interventionist with her. She was kind of winging it based on what she found on the internet. They didn't really know. They didn't have the resources. So all of them kind of looked the same. You know, it was like three versus me or five versus me. And that's how I felt. I just wasn't ready. And it wasn't until my scorecard absolutely read zero that I was ready. The pain was so great. Like, I was like, I can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's when my brother brought me to treatment. He dropped me off with that trash bag. But they all looked the same, man. They were all failed because there was no structure to it. There was no plan. There was no plan if I said yes. It was like, okay, well, you know, we'll take you tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah.
So proper planning on an intervention is super, super critical. Yeah. Knowing, you know, the next step or the destination should the loved one say yes.
Yeah. And it as a family member, it's incredibly challenging. Now, I haven't had to do that yet. My mom has been in the addictions industry for 40 years here in Saskatchewan. She's retired now. And when the time was right, she intervened in just the right way. And, but I'm, you know, like it's, you get angry as a family member, you get angry, you feel hopeless, you're sad, and you bring all of those things to that conversation. Right. So, and I think it's safe to assume that's how those conversations went down, right? Anger and fear and right?
Anger, fear, the resentment, you know, a lot of pointing of the fingers. I mean, those are all great points, and that's exactly what it was like. You know, they just didn't know how to handle it. Yeah. But all that happens because the drug addict, and I'll speak for me, like as a recovered and actively recovering, you know, substance abuse user, and I used it all. It's a family disease. You know, we don't think that we're hurting the loved one. Yeah. But to your point, the loved one is left and they're left without tools. You know, a lot of times, not enough. There's not, you know, there's over 16,000 treatment centers in the United States. Mm-hmm. 16,000. Sounds like it's a lot.
Yeah.
But for the epidemic, it's definitely not. And there still isn't enough information that's out there to help the loved one that's struggling. And that's the family too. You know, a lot of times, you know, people will get recovered. And they go to a fellowship, they go to some sort of AA 12-step based program or some sort of recovery through their church, whatever it may be. And then the family is still left broken and not healed.
Yeah.
And there's programs out there for the families. You know, there's Al-Anon and so many other resources, Nar-Anon for the youth. I mean, there is a lot of information out there, but there isn't enough people either seeking it or feeling safe enough to talk about it and vulnerable to talk about it. Like my family member is struggling with this, you know, where do I go to get help? 2024. I mean, there's other wild shit out there that's going on. Like for me, the drug addict and the alcoholic compared to the laundry list of craziness, that's it going on in our world. And not from a judgmental place, but just from there's a lot of wild stuff going on. I feel like the drug addict is extremely well positioned to get help these current years. And I'm excited for that because as somebody who was so hopeless, you know, and I thought that I had all the answers and I thought that I had arrived because I had a big career as a young guy to be homeless on the street at 28 years old, when you had already accomplished something, it takes a lot of humility to be able to go in and say, you need some help. And I still seek that help today. You know, I don't have the answers now.
Yeah.
And it's been a bunch of years.
So when you, you walked through the treatment center doors or the detox doors or whatever it was, and this time it was different. I think that's safe to assume that something had changed. You'd finally had some experiences that made this time different. When you started to unpack the things that you had been through, did it feel like a weight came off or that a weight came on?
I guess hindsight is both, but the first knee jerk response, which is prefrontal cortex, that's on the top of my mind. It's like, you know, it came on because now it's like, wait a minute, now I have to address all this stuff. Mm. Like but at the same time, I felt a little relief because there was a level of honesty that came right with it. So it was a combination of both. The relief part didn't scare me.
Yeah.
But starting to unpack things and being vulnerable, you know, and again, it goes back to the inner child.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care if you're a drug addict or an alcoholic, a sexaholic or no aholic. You're just a human being. Mm-hmm. We all have this inner child. All of us. You can be textbook, you can be brilliant, you still got this inner child that lives inside and not enough people want to talk about it. Yeah. You know, so that was the scary part for me, was like, wait a minute, all right, I got a problem, admit it. Now I know that's the first step in the fellowship that I go to. Yeah. But like in the treatment center, they weren't talking about that stuff. They were just pushing me through. They had me sit with my clinician first, then go to a group session, then eat a lousy lunch. Then I had to listen to some other recovering alcoholics. Then I had to see the new people coming in and those people maybe sneaking in drugs. And I'm trying to figure out what I'm doing here. There was no concise messaging. So I'm opening up this stuff in a therapy session. Like you asked, like, how did it feel? There's a level of freedom. But then there was this vulnerability that I was very uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
And The problem was, is that when I discharged, there was no plan. So kind of like the intervention, had I said yes, there wasn't a follow-up plan, I'm opening myself up in therapy for the first time, and there was no plan. Mm-hmm. So I was left raw and vulnerable when I left that treatment center, and that wasn't the first time I got and stayed sober. So mm-hmm. I went back out after after the first treatment center I went.
Like right off the hop?
I put a couple months together. You know, I got a sponsor, and I started doing a little bit of step work that lasted for a few months. And I was like, well, wait a minute. I got to get vulnerable with somebody else. Now too many people know my stuff. I'm not safe. And I started to feel raw. I started mm-hmm. to feel open mm-hmm. and not loved. You know, it was like bringing up a lot of shame is really what it was. Yeah. And so I drank over it. I drank over it. I numbed the feelings. Not going back to cocaine. Not doing that. Yeah. Not going to the strip clubs.
I'm
not
okay.
Going to do that.
Yeah.
I'm good. Not going to go to the CD motel. I'm not doing it. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to have a drink because I don't want to feel what I'm feeling. Mm. And that led back to cocaine. That led back to the motels. That led to me getting arrested for some super alcohol that you smoke in a pipe. Ooh. And but the point is, and I'm not like a big war story guy. I kind of like to touch on it just a little. Like that was like progressive for me, like things that I had never done before. Like this disease of addiction is progressive if mm-hmm. left not treated. So I found myself doing drugs that I'd never really done before and getting into trouble. And I wound up getting arrested, and I went to jail, not for very long. It was just, you know, it was basically a hold. And when I got released, I went right back to that super alcohol that you smoke, like instantly. Like the consequence of getting arrested, I just got a lawyer. He got me off, and that was it. So I kept going until April 3rd, 2008. And mm-hmm. my scorecard officially read zero. Mm-hmm. And I had no more answers. And I knew that I was either going to die, go to jail for a really long time. And, you know, I'm pretty tough, but I don't really think that I would do well in jail for very long.
Not jail tough.
Not if jail I had resilient. To be, but I would have been jail resilient. Yeah, I would have figured it out. But, you know, it was like jail, death, or long-term institutions and or sobriety. It was the last house on the block. I hadn't really knocked on the door fully. I got invited to the party in 2006. I got mm-hmm. a taste of it. And I went to a meeting and I saw guys there and they were really happy. And I hated all of them because they were happy.
Screw you, Dr. Pepper drinking old timers.
Yes, you are smoking old timer, you know, you're happy, joyous, and free. I save that. Mm-hmm. But they said, hey, man, good to see you. Welcome back. Make it to midnight. Hmm. And I said, make it to midnight. I was like, that sounds different. One time, you know, a day at a time was on the wall, you know, first things first, think.
Keep it simple.
I heard something different. Keep it simple, stupid, you know, whatever it is. And I learned simplicity is actually intelligence. Mm-hmm. The simpler things are, the more intelligent I become on that, whatever that is in my life. And so I learned all these little sound bites in the beginning, but they started to sound different. And I was open to it and I was willing.
Let's take a quick break here. Let me read out today's sponsors and announcements, and we'll get back into it.
Sounds good.
Fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, known as FASD, is a developmental disorder that can impact anyone. It affects the daily lives of over 4% of Canadians, but with support and services, individuals with FASD can thrive. Learn more at saskfasdnetwork.ca. If you're interested in checking out another Canadian mental health podcaster, there's also a link to that one in the show notes below. To make contact or learn more about today's sponsors, check out our new merch, or if you want to show us some love and buy us a coffee, all of those links are also in the show notes below. So did you make it to midnight?
I made it to midnight. Mm-hmm. Made it to a midnight, and then I wound up getting to another meeting the next day. Mm-hmm. And I saw some of the same guys. They took me to a diner after. Mm-hmm. And it was eight of them. Seven of them sitting, This one guy, Spike. Remember the Tasmanian Devil?
I do.
Cartoon. He was.
I think I was him for a little while, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we all were. You know, I definitely was. I don't want to speak for anybody else, but I think like when you are active in addiction, you just spin around and you whirl around your family. You touched on that and the people that love you. And we actually do hurt more people than just ourselves. But I was sitting at this diner and this one guy was just running around just like a wild dude, like happy. Couldn't stand him. Very loud, from New York. Just there was nothing peaceful about this guy. And, you know, all these years later, he's I would consider him one of my closest friends today. But I look back at the moments and I started to stack my days and started to get more comfortable in a new fellowship and a different language, right? It was English, but they were talking different, man. They were saying different things and they were saying, "Hey, kid." I'm like, "Kid, I'm 31. Let me tell you who I am, kid."
Yeah, here we go. They're like,
yeah. They're like, "Hey, kid, listen. You see that girl over there? If you look at her longer than 3 seconds, we call that lust." What? What's this guy talking about? "Hey, man, those gentlemen clubs that you used to go to, we don't go there anymore. What are you doing 60 days from today on this date? We're all going to this retreat. We want you to come." I'm thinking, I'm not doing a retreat with a bunch of guys. I was like, "Well, what are we going to do with this retreat?" "We're going to do retreat things." My sponsor told me, and I followed my sponsor. I found people. My point was like they were saying different things. They were living a life that it was physically sober. Mm-hmm. They emotionally seemed stable. They thought different. And you know what? Not one of them judged me. Not one of them wanted to know what I did for a living. They didn't want to know my past. They didn't want to know how much money I made, what type of car I was driving or not driving at that time. Mm-hmm. They were repossessed, so I wasn't driving anything. And I was bumming rides off people. So like I look back at the beginning and I was just open and willing, man, to receive some information. And yeah, so I did make it to midnight. I made it to midnight ever since April 3rd, 2008, one day at a time.
Awesome. So yeah, when did you start buying into it? I mean, you were just mentioning how you were thinking like these guys are crazy and I'll show you who's a kid and all of the things. When did your thinking start changing and what did that look like?
Man, there's so many moments. There's like layers to it. I think because there's so many moments. I think it was when I sat with my sponsor, Harry, same guy who had taken a meeting into that treatment center in 2006, a couple years before. And he would meet me early at a meeting and he would meet me after and stay with me after. He would have me at his house on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock and he would go through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous with me, page by page, with a pen and a highlighter. And he would make me underline things and he would pause and explain it. The only book until I got sober that I'd ever completed cover to cover multiple times was the basic text, the AA big book, and the 12 and 12. Yeah. You know, being a high school dropout, I wasn't a high educated guy. So I had like this man. When did I buy in? It was like when somebody invested in me and they didn't want anything from me, nothing except to see me recover. And so Harry introduced me to another guy, Armin, and another guy, John, and the list went on. And I got involved in this fellowship. And they started to show me what it looked like to be of service. The biggest buy-in was when a friend of mine asked me to pick him up the next day. "Hey, Mark, you available tomorrow?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm not working. What do you got going on?" Because I was just watching Oprah. I was looking for jobs and going to AA meetings and watching Oprah. Those were the three things on my bucket list back then. He's like, "Hey, I got to go drop this car off. Could you pick me up tomorrow?" I said, "Well, I got to borrow a car, but I can do that." He sent me a text in the morning and it was a 2.5 hour drive to pick him up. And I didn't back out. I was willing to go show up, and I spent 2.5 hours there by myself and 2.5 hours back with this guy. I was so new in recovery, but I was happy to be of service to somebody else besides myself. Mm-hmm. And I listened to this guy. That guy is still in my life today. So I bought in when people started to ask me to show up and be of service, but also when they started investing in me and showing me like, hey, there's another way of living. But you got to have to do work. You got to go through this book. You got to look at your own defects and you got to look at your behaviors. You got to look at the people you wronged and then you got to go take responsibility for that.
Yeah.
You know, recovery is, there's so much to recovery. There's only, you know, I was taught that there's in that first step, there's a truth and a fact. And the truth is that I'm powerless to the day I die. I got enough evidence, you know, of active addiction that I'm powerless over alcohol and drugs. I'm powerless today and I'll be powerless to the day I die. But the fact that my life was unmanageable, that just means like that can and will change. And I can say today, 16 years later, it has changed. And if I'm not maintaining that spiritual work, I can quickly go back to that active alcoholic. But it's going to happen in different forms today. I'm not going to go straight to the drink. Yeah. It's going to come in the form of many work. Things.
Social media, work. Whatever.
Social media, yeah. Sex, pornography, yeah. Looking at websites, just looking at things that I shouldn't be looking at because they're not healthy for my mind.
Yeah.
You know, people eat an enriched, healthy diet. They'll work out. What are people doing, including myself, to feed healthy thoughts to my mind? And it's all proximity. It's who I'm surrounding myself with, what I'm choosing to listen to. So, you know, you asked me a question about when did I buy in. That lesson has served me really well because I don't want to just get sober and stop drinking and then maybe do okay in life. Like, wait a minute. God chose me to get sober.
Yeah.
That's a powerful thought for me. I'm all about the mind today.
That's interesting. And I've been coming to this realization myself over these past months. And I, you know, you see people on social media saying like, oh, getting sober was the best thing I ever did. And I get it, but lately I've started to question myself, like if getting sober is the best thing I ever do, I feel like that's like a waste of sobriety. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. You know, and a lot of people get sober and then they live in the rooms.
Or they stop
going to the rooms altogether. It's tough, man. AA, NA, whatever A, it's very judgmental. I wouldn't have gotten sober without it. I haven't gotten away from it. But there's no better. Like, I don't think I'm better or worse than any human being. I really don't. I really, really, really don't. I know how sick I still am. Like, I need to do work on me. But at the same time, one life. I finally got to this place. This is where I'm at.
Yeah.
One life. 24 hours to live it, maybe. What am I going to do with my time?
Yeah.
And if I'm allowing things to occupy my time that don't serve me, that's on me. If I engage in conversations that don't serve me or make me better so I can show, perfect example, if I'm not maintaining my emotional sobriety, you know, the way that I got to you and you and I had a call, you probably wouldn't want to have a conversation. Mm-hmm. And maybe from this conversation, you and I together collaborating can help somebody else or another family member. You know, so that's the way that I look at it. It's like, all right. And it's tough because a lot of people don't understand that. A lot of people are judgmental.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what I tell my son last night at 10 o'clock when he's in tears because he lost his soccer game. Mm-hmm. Big soccer game. My son Maven, and I have two boys, Maven and Max. Maven is my sobriety baby.
Yeah.
Again, I thought I was going to die in that motel room 16 years ago. To be a father, to be entrusted, to have a wife, you know, to be a husband. All blessings. But when you're sitting one-on-one with your son and he's crying and he feels like he let you down, keeping in mind how I told you I was raised, right? I kept a lot of the war stories out because there was a lot of drama. It doesn't matter, but there was. My dad was never around. My father wasn't saying what I said to Maven last night was, "Buddy, I love you. I don't care if you score a goal. I don't care about your grades in school. I care about your head and your heart and that you feel safe to have a conversation with your dad." 100%. And a lot of times, human beings, when we're interacting, we don't give each other space to feel safe, especially in relationships.
Yeah.
You know, husbands, wives, whatever the marriage may be or relationship may be, we don't give each other space to step in and have that safe conversation. Mm-hmm. But I was able to step in and do that last night and have a conversation about limitations with my son. Because what was happening was he didn't show up the best version of himself. And the reason he didn't show up the best version of himself was because he had limitations. He went in a little bit scared. He's lost to this team before. He's told himself a story.
Yeah.
That he's not good enough to beat them. So you know what? I'm going to try, but what's the point? I think that's the story he was telling himself. Back to what I was saying earlier, which is we all have this inner child that we take into our adult life. It's all framework. It's a whole setup.
Yeah, yeah.
So I want to smash that. Sobriety, being sober, seeking information, following men that came before me. They taught me to look at this type of stuff. So I told Maeve, I go, "Maeve, every human being puts limitations on themselves until they learn that they don't have to." I said, "You're 12. When you're 13, you'll smash it. 14, 15. If I can, I'm just going to help you smash it and open up the ceiling so you don't have a limitation." I just want his brain to think like that. When we first get sober, it's not about that. You know, it's not about thinking like that. But once we have a little bit of time and a little bit of success had, or perhaps that I've had, we owe it to other people to get out there and serve. That's what God has called me to do, is at least how I feel about my life. I feel abundantly blessed emotionally and spiritually and definitely financially, but I feel called to serve other human beings. And however that message is going to get out there, I'm all for it.
So looking back, now that you've done, and this might be a little bit about personal growth and that inner child work and things like that, but looking back, what were you running from? From the first time you got high to the time you finally stepped away from it, what was chasing you down that dark hallway?
I don't think I was running away from anything. I think I was running to something. I think I was running to, like I said earlier, to try to seek that validation and that safety and that comfort of like, it's okay. Because I didn't have that. You know, I think when I was a baby, my mom probably changed my diapers and gave me bottles. She likes to remind me that she did love me. She did love me. She tells me that. But I don't remember feeling that love. So I think I was running to something or someone versus running away. I think that's the best way to describe that feeling.
You weren't trying to escape. You were trying to, you were searching. You were looking.
I was searching and looking. The times that I was trying to escape, maybe it was a feeling, right, of brokenness. But again, I was just looking to fill that with a void. And I did that really well with sex and money. Like those were my two vices for a long time. You know, I didn't – every woman in my life – and I'll say it a second time – every woman in my life has cheated on me. So what do you think that would tell – somebody about relationships, that you can't trust your partner, you're gonna get cheated on? And that's a really hard thing, especially for a guy to accept, like, well, wait a minute, every single woman in my life has cheated on me. What is that gonna tell me about the next relationship that I'm in? How am I gonna trust? How am I gonna be vulnerable?
Tell you that love is dangerous. It's not safe.
Love is dangerous. It's not safe. And like I said, I was seeking safety. So a lot of times, and looking back, I didn't know what a healthy relationship looked like. And again, another blessing of sobriety. It's like the first person that you got to be able to love is yourself before you can love anybody else. I used to hear that and be like, that's such a crock of shit. What are you talking about? I can love somebody. I don't need to love or like everything about me. Have you seen her? I love her. And there were plenty of different hers.
Yeah.
So yeah, man, like these – looking back at the beginning part of sobriety and where I am today, there's just a tremendous amount of healing. And I don't want to chase today or seek or run to something. Today, my solution is I go vertical before I go horizontal. Hmm. I go through prayer. Mm-hmm. I get out of me. Sometimes it's long. Sometimes it's detailed. Sometimes it's so specific. Like specific prayers, like, God, please bless my life so big I need to grow into it. Put people in my life that I can serve. Sometimes it sounds like that. And that's exactly what I got. It didn't all come like a tidal wave. It's not like I got sober and everything got great. I got sober and the shit hit the fan is really what happened.
Yeah, that's the truth, man. That is the truth. I didn't have my first suicidal thought till I was 9 months sober.
Yeah, I can relate to those thoughts too.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, yeah. I think that's a good point. It's like when I pray that prayer, it's not about stuff. It's like, bless my life so big I need to grow into it. It's like that limiting belief. Bless my life so big I need to grow into it. Remove any limitations that I put on myself as a human being. Mm-hmm. Where do those all come from? Past experiences. Where's most of that from? My inner child. Bless my life so big I need to grow into it. There's so many different meanings. Maybe somebody listening can think about an area of their life that they want to grow that has nothing to do with the worldly clamors, nothing shiny, not about money, just about growing spiritually. Listen, I'm a Jewish kid from outside Boston who's a practicing Christian. I have the Lord in my life today. I have no idea how that even happened. I'm so grateful it did. I'm wide open to support anybody in anything, but like for what I believe and what we believe in my home, to go from the drug addict, homeless on the street, to be willing to accept the Lord in his life, no better, no worse. That's a huge shift. That didn't happen because I woke up one day and say, I got this. It was like, I needed to follow men that came before me. And that's exactly what I did. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you, like I said earlier, I wouldn't change one thing in my life that I've had to experience because all of that adversity, all of that pain, all of the owing the IRS money, being unemployable, having to explain my resume, repair and go through the steps and take responsibility for things that I forgot that I did, but I got reminded of. All those little things were little wins that stacked upon each other and stacked upon each other until I started to have a shift in my DNA and I started to feel different. And the validation that I was seeking in others, I was able to tap into on my own because I was doing work. And the only way that I could learn that work was by following other men that came before me. A huge, huge blessing until what you just talked about. And I want to touch on that. And I appreciate you sharing that with me from a place of vulnerability, man, because here I am stacking these wins, got a job, paid off the IRS, met a girl, got married, had a baby, had another baby. Chose to leave a profession that I was in for all those years, for close to 20 years, make a career shift, 8 going on 9 years sober. Everything is good. Challenging moments, but everything is good.
Every day's challenging, man. Crazy if you
every
think it isn't.
Every day's challenging. And I'm going to AA every day, and I'm sponsoring other men. And I wake up one morning, 11 years sober. My whole life just felt like it came crashing down in my home. And I found myself like vulnerable again. And
what happened?
So my wife and I, when I left my financial career, and I left at the top of my career, I repaired myself and I did really well. Like I said, we got married and had children. When I left that to step into a new business and that I was starting with a business partner, my marriage started to go like this. And we had a second child. Mm-hmm. Now listen, AA and the men there had prepared me for all those stages leading up to the one when you're young father, young husband. Pressure is high, colicky baby, no sleeping, bickering and arguing with your partner without any other foundation of what a healthy relationship looks like. What tends to happen is people find themselves, which I did and my wife did, susceptible to the opposite sex. And so I had entertained a female for a period of time, for a few months. Mm-hmm. My wife had found out, and that did not go over well at all. And then I started questioning, like, well, wait a minute. Am I my father? Do I love this woman? I had doubts before about her and I. Is this new path that I'm walking the one that God wants me on? There was a lot of introspective work on it, but I decided to take responsibility, mm-hmm. to own it, make amends, apologize, go to a men's retreat, and turn my life in. I did a 180. Mm-hmm. A lot of things that I was doing, but I did them even better. And I thought my relationship was solid. You know, a lot of therapy. We'd never done therapy together. And so long story short, you know, about a year after that, that moment with my wife and I woke up and I found out that my wife had a full-blown affair for a year and a half prior.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it all started to make sense. That was just a lot more cynical and unacceptable to me. Not that one was better or worse, but it triggered everything inside of me. Like I told you, every woman had cheated on me.
Yeah.
It triggered all this bullshit that I had no idea how to handle. And I didn't drink and I didn't drug. Suicide seemed like a good idea. And I lost 30 pounds in 6 weeks. I packed up all my stuff. I moved out of my home, said goodbye to my kids. My choice to leave. Now I'm in control. So I thought, okay, can't drink, can't get high. And I need to get some help. And that's what I did. And I stayed out of my home. I filed for divorce. And I was going down that path. And it was hard, man, when you have kids and then you start looking at your life like you're repeating what your father and your mother did to you.
Yeah.
And I would see my children. I would drop them off on the weekend. It's really hard. And I decided to remove the divorce, to step back in, to try to heal that, to try to understand why I did what I did, why she did what she did, and how do we impact our children in the right way that God intended. Those years that happened, God was not at the center of our relationship.
Yeah.
So looking back, I realized, like, you know, there was everything happens for a reason, including that. Like, I can safely, comfortably talk about this because this is a very common topic that people do not want to talk about. And I'm so grateful that God has softened my heart to talk about it.
Something different but similar happened in our relationship. And towards the end of our relationship, our son was apprehended and Donna left me for another man to a life on the street. And it went completely sideways for her immediately. She spent 18 months being unhoused, escaping extreme domestic violence. I got sober. I mean, all of my listeners have heard this before, but but in the end of it all, she got sober. She came back. We went to court. It was ugly as hell, custody. But now we've been back together for over 2 years and we're raising these kids together and our life is beautiful. We just bought a home together. So I hear what you're saying.
And it can happen, and there's healing that can happen, and it takes time, and it's like, but what are we doing here?
Yeah.
Like, what else are we doing here? Everybody, you know, everybody wants to be on this thing, and they want to scroll and click and get views and do this and get comments. And I play that game too for my business. Like, I get it. One life, 24 hours. You know, if you believe in God, which I do, he either is or he isn't. I choose that he is, and I choose that he's going to put people in my life that are going to challenge me, that are going to make me better. But I get to be a power of example. My kids, my oldest son, you know, you see a couple pictures behind me. My oldest son, he knew what happened. He knew what mommy did. He knew what daddy did. Mm-hmm. We had to go work on that. That was the worst shame that I had ever felt, more than anything that I had ever felt before, because he didn't choose that. I put that on him. My wife put that on him. Mm-hmm. And that's the other part of sobriety. It's like, look, I like to have fun. You know, I am a business guy, but I also like, I'm a big AA guy. I like to put my hat on backwards. I like to be at the soccer fields with my kids. I like to drop the fuck bomb every once in a while. Like, I'm sometimes politically not correct. I'm pretty easygoing, but for the most part, I'm very disciplined. No, I am. I am. I'm very disciplined, but easygoing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I say all that because it's like, I get to be me, authentically me. Mm-hmm. And I used to hear people talk about it. They're like, I know exactly who I am, and I'm so comfortable in my skin, and what other people think about me is none of my business. I'm like, yeah, right. Like, you're totally concerned with other people. I finally have found or tapped into the beginning stages of that. And that is a new freedom. And they talk about that. They say, you're going to find a new freedom and a new happiness. And there's layers to that also. So the more, I think that like the more authentically, the more I'll speak for me in an eye, you know, the more authentically I become in tune with who I am, the more comfortable in my skin I am, and the more impact I can have in somebody else's life, because it's not about me.
Let me ask you something. Let's call it an exercise. I'll ask you this question, and then I'll answer it myself. If you were sitting across the table from your addiction, was sitting in a chair across the table from you, just looking at you, what would you say?
Thank you.
Why?
Thank you for all of the pain. Thank you for all the lessons. Thank you for bringing me to my knees so I could find a relationship that I never knew existed. Thank you for making my world a complete hell, so I know that it exists and it's where I don't want to be. Thank you. I would thank my addiction.
Mm-hmm. I would say, thank you for trying to help. That's it. I think we all just want to feel better. And I think that that's what causes a whole bunch of pain in this world, is that we are all just seeking a way to be okay.
Amen to that, brother.
So where can people find you, man?
So you can find me on Instagram at Mark, M-A-R-C, Efron, E-F-F-R-O-N. You can find me at my corporation, or one of that works within healthcare and behavioral health, which is www.legacyhealing.com. We're a behavioral health company. We span from Los Angeles, California to South Florida, all the way up to the Northeast. And we help loved ones seek a better way from substance abuse, mental health, and trauma. We work intensely with families as well. I think those are the two best places to find me. We'll keep it simple.
Is there anything that you would like to say, anything you'd like to leave us with today? Someone out there struggling like you did, what would you say?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to say. Just to keep it simple, just ask for the help and show up. You really will be amazed before you're halfway through. And when it gets tough and it gets really, really hard, and it will, like if anybody says this is going to be easy, it's not. But if you have the opportunity, it's meant for you. If you've been given the blessing of just a moment break and you hear something that sounds attractive, like, I like that, go in that direction. It's meant for you to hear it in that moment. You will not regret stepping into recovery.
Thanks so much for joining me today, Mark. I think that was a great conversation. Happy to have you back sometime.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks. I'm honored to be here with you, man.
Awesome.
It's a good time.
Take care, man.
Thanks. Take care.
Okay, if you got anything out of that, talk, please hit that like button at the bottom of the screen. If you're not yet subscribed to us on YouTube, please hit that subscribe button, turn on notifications. We're going live all the time. We have like 280 some episodes at the time of this recording. We got lots of things. We got something for everyone. So check us out. That's all I got for you today, everyone. Thanks. Take care.
Say, this is Hard Knocks Talks.